right, please be seated. Calling Greenwald Family Limited Partnership versus Village of Maquonago, 21 AP 69FT. Could I please start with your appearances? Good morning to both of you. Slight adjustment in the calendar. You requested and were granted the opportunity to have 20 minutes to start, followed by 10 minutes in rebuttal, and you'll have 30 minutes total. So I think with that, we're prepared to proceed. I'll note that Justice Hagedorn is participating, but he's on the telephone. So please try to listen if you can hear that someone's trying to speak, because he'll ask questions that way. He did that last oral argument, and we'll do that here as well if he has any. So we'll keep an ear out for that. All right, let's proceed.
Again, good morning, and may it please the court. Acting for the petitioner GFLP, and contrary to the village's position in the case, I serve the clerk of the village with the notice of appeal document that is issued at issue in this case. That was done by serving the attorney of record for her municipality, the village. This was appropriate. Looking at the case the other way, had I served the clerk directly after having already properly served a summons and complaint on the village's attorney, he may well have been concerned and probably would have objected. That is because the doctrine that is at issue in this case is that Wisconsin Stats 801.14 sub 2 requires service of all documents subsequent to the summons and complaint on the attorney of record. If I had thought to myself, well, the statute says serve the clerk of the town, village, or city, and section 801.14 says I shall serve the attorney for the party, maybe I can defend by claiming that the clerk is not a party to the case. It is my strong sense that the attorney for the village would have objected, and rightly so. It makes no sense to serve the clerk separately and in person once the attorney for the clerk's village is the attorney on the matter. Serving the clerk is indeed the, quotes, end around of section 801.14, which requires the attorney to receive the documents. And that attorney is the only one who gets them, no one else. That is to avoid direct contact between attorneys and litigants, and because the attorney is the governor or controller of the case after he or she enters the case. They get the information in the case, and they communicate with their clients. The plain language makes the clerk a part of the party here under 801.14. The term party in 801.14 is, I think, at issue in the case.
So you're, are you saying the clerk, I just want to make sure I heard you correctly, did you say the clerk is part of the party?
Yes, that's the language says the clerk of the village. So the clerk of the village essentially served the village, served the clerk, the representative of the village, to be of something.
So do you represent every employee of the village?
That's not really, I think, the proper framework. Certainly, the village attorney may not represent the clerk in some individual capacity about some other matter. But in this case, who is the party with respect to the petitioner or the plaintiff? The party is the village defendant. The attorney has accepted service on behalf of the defendant. And this subsequent document needs to be served on the clerk of the village. So why would I assume that the clerk of the village is not part of that defended party? In fact, confronted with this, for me, admittedly confusing language, especially in context of the case law, I erred on the side of saying, boy, I better not mess around with 801.14. It says I shall serve the party, unless there's like a court order.
Well, it says you shall serve a written notice of appeal upon the, upon the clerk.
Yes. So here's the thing with that. Serve is not defined. So what do you do if you're in litigation? You look at how do we serve documents on parties. You go to 801, chapter 801, and you see 801.14, and it says Everything after the summons and complaint shall be served on the attorney for that party. And so that's a shall, that's a duty. So at best, I think, for the village, maybe there's a conflict. I don't really see it as a conflict. I see it as doing exactly what's precisely required. Serve is not defined in the special assessment statute. I think the premise here of the lower courts, and I think the village has continued this, is to rely on, to some extent, the inside sense of lawyers and judges that serve means personal service, hire a process server, and serve. And that you didn't do that. Well, that may be, right? But when there's an attorney involved, 801.14 sub 2 kicks in. Right? So I could have served the clerk directly, but I asked the attorney for the village if he would accept service of the summons and complaint. He admitted service. Then I had this second document, which frankly is unclear if it has to be served or not, because the summons and complaint stands in the place of that document under the case law. But I said, okay, let's be careful and thorough. Let's serve that. And so I submitted it by mail, which is proper service, on the attorney of record. Again, the plain language makes the clerk a part of the party under 801.14.
So can I ask, if the clerk is not a party, does your argument fail?
No. The clerk is a party. The clerk is part
of
the party.
Okay. If we were to say that the clerk is not a party, does your argument fail?
I don't know that it fails.
How do you prevail if we say that the clerk, village clerk, is not a party?
Well, the service that was the case law would support the idea that service was proper. It wasn't a jurisdictional issue to serve the notice of appeal, and the documents that were provided to the attorney were sufficient to achieve the purposes of the notice of appeal language in 660703. So I would be arguing a kind of a even if this was sufficient position. We haven't focused on that in the briefs, but certainly that's applicable. In particular, with respect to a critical issue to me in this case, which is how this court has dealt with ambiguity in that statute.
Have you reviewed the statutory history here? Because the predecessor statute, as I read it, had service being affected on the village by service on the clerk. So the clerk was basically serving what I think would be called the ministerial duty of accepting service on behalf of the village. So the clerk, it seems, under the predecessor statute was, in fact, the village for purposes of service.
I agree fully, and it was. I think the case in 1999-2000, maybe the Outagamie County case, Court of Appeals case, focused on that older language. In that case, the county in that case was the petitioner, and they had filed in circuit court first. They had filed only with the clerk. And the town in that case took a different position, said, no, you have to file in circuit court. The clerk, you can't file with her. They changed the statute. And now, to start the case, you file in circuit court. Either way, the clerk is the representative of the party, of the village, as Your Honor said. So the clerk is not served in her isolated or independent capacity, whatever that might possibly be. I don't know how we slice that and separate clerk from clerk of the village, clerk of the defendant. Clerk is a part of the village.
In fact, it would be kind of strange, wouldn't it, that the clerk would be sued as some independent party, independent from the village for a tax assessment? I wouldn't even understand how the clerk would be a separate party contextually.
Totally agree. It's a very strained argument in our view. Creates confusion and conflict, which again is easily resolved in this case because this case has the attorney of record admitting service. So 801.14 is triggered. That's important. The briefing has sort of approached this as if I was randomly serving some attorney who used to represent or occasionally represented the village. No. This is the attorney who admitted service on behalf of the village in this particular case. Because of that, 801.14 sub 2 at least has to be consulted. And I think to harmonize that directive, the mandatory shall in 801.14(2), with the term serve in the special assessment statute, you serve the attorney who's admitted service. And again, you say, well, the clerk is said to be served the clerk. Well, the clerk is of the party, right? And the Court of Appeals even made that reference. It wasn't an analyze, as we're doing here today, but it's an obvious meaning of the statute. The clerk of the party means serve the party, the official representative of the party.
Counsel, help me with this, if you can. Justice Rebecca Bradley just referenced a predecessor statute that seemed to be language that you embraced as that's right, except that's the prior statute. And oftentimes in our opinions we write, you know, if the legislature wanted to write it in, it knows how to do that. And apparently a good example of that is the predecessor statute. Help me with this then. By the very fact that language no longer exists, doesn't that in some ways undermine your argument? And if not, why not?
The language is different in the newer statute. The older statute provided that in order to appeal to the circuit court, the petitioner has to cause a written notice of appeal to be served upon the clerk of such city, town, or village. That's the older language. The new language separates that and says you appeal to circuit court, period. Then notice of appeal shall be served upon the clerk. I think serving the notice of appeal on the clerk, according to the Maya case and the other cases, is something of a vestige. It doesn't really need to happen anymore because the summons and complaint is equivalent. But what's the same in the statutes is of the village, clerk of the village. So I think it's very consistent with what Justice Rebecca Bradley said, which is it's the same language in both, but there's two sentences. So in the earlier one, you were solely focused on the clerk. The proceeding started with the clerk. The clerk received all the initiating documents, or at least that's what the language could be read as. By the way, that was also considered ambiguous in the case I cited, because they filed in circuit court first, the county, or the MIAC folks, and that was considered okay. So there's a lot of confusion in the way that courts of appeals, not so much this court, has applied this language, the old and the new. The key language to me is it's the clerk of the municipality. By the way, the municipality, the village itself, is the defendant. You will see in the briefing by the village some idea, kind of a newly created idea, frankly, that the governing body of the village is somehow the client of the attorney, and that maybe that's the defendant. I think that's not accurate. It's not what happened. The attorney for the village admitted service for the defendant village. All the cases are captioned petitioner versus the village or the city. It never says the governing body of the municipality. So that's a distracting argument. The defendant here is the village.
Counsel, I just want to clarify my line of questioning, because it appears, as I read the predecessor statute and the current statute, that there were merely stylistic changes made and that the legislature was not working a substantive change. The reason why that's relevant, of course, is because the case on which you're relying, Mayak, interpreted the prior statute, and as I read Mayak, the Court of Appeals in that case held that the service of the summons and complaint was sufficient to initiate the appeal. So you don't need a separate notice of appeal to initiate your cause of action because the summons and complaint was served on the village. Is that a fair summary of your argument?
Exactly fair. I think it's exactly right. The Maya case addressed language that is the same language effectively in the new statute. MIAC also addressed 801.14(2). We didn't get into it in the briefing here. It's somewhat confusing because in that case, they initially tried to file with the clerk early, then they filed in circuit court, then after the time expired, they served the clerk. And the Court of Appeal says, Mayak initially served the district clerk and the district through counsel answered the complaint. Section 801.14(2) permitted him to serve the amended pleadings upon the attorney. The analogy here is the village admitted service, which is the analogy in the Mayak case to the sanitary district answering the complaint. So,
can I ask of what import it is that service was admitted here? In other words, I guess I'm curious, are you arguing that service must always be done to the attorney for the village, or because if 801.14 sub 1 applies in all of these cases, then you could not actually serve it on the village clerk. You should always go to the attorney. Or are you saying it's different in this case because of the admitted service of a summons and complaint? I'd just like to understand your argument on that.
Yes. Thank you, Justice. Very good to bring that up again. It's the latter. It's different in this case because of the admission of service by the attorney. That attorney goes from merely representing the village generally to representing the village in this case. And therefore, as a officer of the court subject to 801.14, I have to determine whether subsequent documents that are not the summons and complaint, where those need to be served. And I'm directed that it shall be on the attorney representing that party. The village will say, well, you should have read the term party and said, well, clerk, that's not the party. That's an absurd reading, in my view. I don't see how we get there. Respectfully, Justice Dallas said, what if we decide that? I would hope we would not, because it would create even more confusion in the statute. The point I want to make here in my last few minutes of my initial period is to mention the doctrine that the Court of Appeals and this Court has referenced when they've addressed the statute. First of all, it's ambiguous in various ways.
I'm having a hard time seeing how the person appealing shall serve a written notice of appeal upon the clerk is ambiguous.
How do we do that? That's the question. How do you do that? Serve is not defined. There's no procedure described in 660703.
So this is what I'm struggling with, and maybe I'm just not understanding. Why wouldn't you serve them both? Why wouldn't you serve the written notice of appeal upon the clerk, and why wouldn't you also serve the attorney? Is there some reason you can't do both of those?
Yeah, 801.14 sub 2, because a summons and complaint had been filed in court and served on the party. So I'm limited now in only serving documents on the party through the attorney.
I don't see only. It says the service shall be made upon the attorney.
It says all documents, unless otherwise ordered by the court, subsequent to the summons. Which is a very common understanding in litigation, of course.
Well, I'm not seeing the word all. The second phrase of the first sentence reads, the service shall be made upon the attorney unless service upon the party in person is ordered by the court. So you're saying that you're not allowed to serve the clerk under 66.0703?
Yes. That's what 801.14 dictates. You don't want the attorney interacting directly with the litigants. That's what the purpose of that statute is.
Okay, I have a question about 66.0703 sub 12. Are you saying that because I think this is a process, right, that's very particular to this type of challenge, and it may or may not have an attorney, a person may not have an attorney representing them. So if the average person were to read this statute, are you saying that they shouldn't be serving a written notice of appeal upon the clerk, but they should instead be figuring out that they have to do it on the attorney for the village?
No. And this is important because the progression of events is why this is different. You can and I really should seek out admission of service from counsel for the party. This is commonly done. Once that happens, and the attorney represents the party, as a lawyer and officer of the court, under 801.14, you have to then comply with those provisions. The layperson would serve, they would look it up, they'd try to figure it out, they'd say, how do I serve the village? They might ask the attorney, they might do other things. If they ask for admission of service, well, then good for them. But this case does not affect that. It doesn't affect the meaning of serve generally in 66.07.03. What it does is says serve means use this provision 801.14, which you're directed to do. That's how you serve the clerk with that second
but
document.
But you are saying then that the average lay person is then supposed to know that even though it tells you exactly what to do in 66, if you're making this type of challenge, they should know that they should instead be under 801 and they should be seeking out the attorney, because that's what I hear you saying.
No, I'm sorry. I misspoke. No. I'm the attorney. I know the stuff. I figured it out. I sought the admission of service from the attorney for the village. Because of that, 801.14 is triggered. If a layperson just wants to serve the clerk, there's no actually way to do that in 66.07. It doesn't say. They can figure it out, or they can hire an attorney. That's what they would be subject to, and they would focus on the clerk.
They can't just hand it to the clerk?
Pardon?
They can't go into the village and hand it to the clerk?
Actually, you can't serve things in person. You have to hire someone. You're not supposed to. If you're the party.
Hire someone to go take it to the clerk?
Absolutely they can. But in that case, you wouldn't have the attorney already saying, I'm accepting service. And they do that because they don't want you interacting with their client, which is reasonable. So I don't want to be punished for following that rule, which is also has an ethical basis. Don't communicate with persons who are represented.
Your time is up. Thank you.
Oh, I'm done. Sorry.
Good morning. May it please the court. Ramsey Batar on behalf of the village of Maguanago. The issue of whether 66.07.03.12a applies is a straightforward analysis. That is this Supreme Court's decision in MJ, paragraph 34. And what I just heard here is a confusing array of statutory interpretation and the facts of this case. Statutory interpretation is not a search for ambiguity, and that's precisely what GFLP does throughout its briefing and in this oral argument. There's almost no citation to any of this court's key case law governing the principles of statutory interpretation. There's almost no tracking of the methodology that this court follows for statutory interpretation, looking at the plain language of a statute. Nor is there really a true reflection of the facts in this case.
Counsel, I read your interpretation and application of these statutes as well as the village's practice to be a strict construction of the statutes, and we're not supposed to interpret the statutes strictly. We're supposed to do so reasonably. So in this case, counsel for the village was accepted service of a summons and complaint. Could you address how, in your interpretation, the summons and complaint comes into play in these statutes, and particularly Chapter 66, is it your position that that's not notice of an appeal to the village?
It's not, because that case law that reflected that the notice of appeal could be done through a summons and complaint was the Outagamie case, I believe, which was considering the prior statute. Under the current statute, and the petitioners agree, there are two things that need to be done. Under the first sentence, you walk into court and you file your summons and complaint. Number two, you file a notice of appeal upon the clerk. And those statutes specifically indicate that you're suing the governing body, and secondly, that you're providing the notice of appeal document to the court.
So what about the argument on the other side that, no, we don't want to have an individual serving the party, right, serving the clerk, right? We don't want that to happen, and that's why we want to go through the attorney. How do you address that?
Because that never happened in this case. They're not pointing out that the notice of appeal was not filed in the circuit court. They're also not pointing out that the village's general counsel, who doesn't just represent the village, but nonetheless, he did not appear in that action. 801.14 does not apply until issue is joined and that attorney walks into the court. From that point forward, you use 801.14 and you serve all counsel of record. And what's very interesting, as I looked through some of the case law, and this court should really be following the MJ case from 2011, cited in the briefing, as well as 519 Corporation cited in the briefing, which deals with the parallel notice of appeal that is done in condemnation matters, and where the court found that actual notice is not sufficient, and where the court found that even if it leads to a harsh result, that
That's
has to be...
That's a different statute, though. You're talking about a different statute.
Different statute, but
okay.
The language
right,
is pretty similar.
We're having enough trouble with the statute
yeah.
Not, so I suggest you focus on
But
that.
The language is actually pretty similar, and I think that this court, as a matter of precedent and stare decisis, can certainly look at what we discussed about 519 Corporation in that case. And as I looked at 519 Corporation yesterday, I shepherdized it. My young law clerks don't know what shepherdizing means anymore, but I looked at what happened with it. And you should look at a case called Gangler. Gangler versus Wee Power, or Wisconsin Energy Power Company. 110 Wis 2nd, 649-1983 from this court. It's sometimes known as In Regard Wisconsin Power Company. It's sometimes cited in the case law as Gangler, G-A-N-G-L-E-R. And that case, interestingly, deals with two issues that the petitioners bring up here. One, serving the attorney as agent. And that case says it's black letter rules of law that when serving the notice of appeal in a condemnation matter, again, a similar analog, serving the attorneys as agent is not sufficient. Attorneys as agents are not authorized to accept service of process. It also says that it's black letter law that you only serve the counsel when the action has begun and they've appeared. It also rejected any kind of special circumstances that would alleviate the harsh consequences of those rules. And when you look at that case, you'll find that those special circumstances wouldn't apply here either. And that's because they never filed the notice of appeal in the circuit court. The admission of service form in this case is titled Admission of Service of Summons and Complaint, and it only references the summons and complaint.
Why isn't that notice? It says in the complaint what is being requested. What you want them to put a label on the, if they put a label on the complaint, in addition to complaint, next to it they put notice, then will you be happy with it? It says the same thing as a notice.
Because under the statute, it is two documents. The second is the notice of appeal that has to be served on the clerk. And as this court's precedents make clear, including in MJ, when you have a procedural statute that lays out certain things that need to be done, that has to be done in order to gain the court's competency to proceed over the subject matter of the action. It was not done here.
Okay, what you're saying is there was not a second document that was served on the clerk of the village. I get that. And the argument on the other side is that service is defined not by personally giving it to the clerk. I get all of that. But what I don't understand from your argument is why you think it needs to be a different document. I mean, if you take the complaint and you put notice above the word complaint and you serve that document on the clerk of the village, you'd be happy, wouldn't you?
Yes, you would. If you called that a summons and complaint and notice of appeal, and you served it on the clerk, we would not be here today. And if he had done that, we would not be here today.
But they're not two separate. What I'm trying to get to is, to me, I feel like you're asking us to dance on the head of a pin a little bit. What's important about the statute is to let the village know what's going on, let the people in the village that are going to have to take, or employees of the village, who are going to have to take some type of action. And I think the clerk of the village has additional obligations after service to do some things, okay, when an appeal arises. But to say they have to be two separate documents, I don't get that. Everything that you want the village to know about is in the complaint. So if it's in the complaint, what you really say is, no, you have to personally give that complaint to the village. Because if you did, you would say that's okay, right?
If he had called it a summons and complaint.
Doesn't matter what he calls it. Come on. I mean, you could get a pencil and write it on top of complaint. Write notice above it. Come on. But it contains all of the information that you think the clerk ought to have, correct?
The complaint might contain their allegations,
did
their criticism.
Did you read the complaint?
I did read the complaint.
Does it contain everything?
It contains their three reasons, substantively, why they think the special assessment should be challenged.
Okay, fine. So it gives notice about what the plaintiffs are complaining about here, right? And your complaint to us is the complaint could be held to say that, but somebody should give it to the clerk physically, not having it, quote, served by giving it to the attorney for the village. So that's where the complaint is, right? Not that the city didn't have notice, or I don't know what the clerk has had, because I don't know whether the city gave the document to the clerk or not. That's not in the record. At least if it is, it's not anything I've read.
Well, if the court wants to give them a break, I don't know where we stop. The plain language of the statute says, serve a notice of appeal. And the legislature amended that statute after some of that case law we talked about earlier.
What does notice of appeal do? What's appeal?
The notice of appeal does two things. Number one, it has to contain the questions of law or fact involving the making of the improvements, the assessment of benefits, or the levy. So it has to contain their criticisms, their objections to the notice of appeal.
And
number
you said
two,
the complaint had three different complaints about the assessment.
The plain language of the statute says, serve this notice of appeal containing the questions of law or fact upon the clerk. And the clerk, at that point, number two, has statutory obligations. She has to assemble that with a brief statement of the proceedings of the matter before the body. She has to give the body the decision on the matter, and she has to prepare the transcript of all the proceedings to be given to the court.
Right.
So the notice of appeal is in the plain language of the statute. It means something, and that's not the issue in this case. There's no dispute what the notice of appeal ought to include. There's also no dispute in this case. It's plaintiff's opening brief, page 11 and 14. The notice of appeal is a separate document.
So the total dispute here is that counsel served the attorney for the village instead of hiring someone to take the complaint and give the complaint to the clerk, right? That's the whole dispute that we're fussing about here.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. I just want to be sure I understand your argument.
They served the summons and complaint in court. The next day, they go to the attorney and ask, will you accept service of the summons and complaint? It's not until 23 days later that it finally dawns on them that they're not complying with the statute because there's no notice of appeal. 23 days later, he goes to the attorney. Here's a notice of appeal. That's the problem. He could have, at the outset, filed the summons and complaint and served that on the attorney along with a notice of appeal and said, will you accept all of this for the clerk? Didn't do that. He could have sued the village board along with the village clerk and done the same thing and asked for the waiver. That's not this case. They did not file the notice of appeal with the clerk. They did not file the notice of appeal with the court. They did not ask Attorney Bloom to accept the notice of appeal. They also don't point out that under 801.14 sub 2, its last sentence says, the first sentence of this subsection shall not apply to service of a summons or of any process of the court. They also do not point out section 801.01, sub 1 and sub 2, both of which say that chapters 801 to 847 governing civil procedure apply to civil actions and special proceedings, and here's the key language, unless a specific provision of procedure in a special proceeding exists. And you find that in both sub 1 and sub 2. They ignore all of that. They also ignore the fact that 801.14 and 801.11, which, by the way, is a new argument they raised in the reply brief, was not presented to the Circuit Court or the Court of Appeals. But in both 801.11 and 801.14, there is no reference back to Chapter 66. There's no reference back to 66.0703. There's no reference whatsoever to a notice of appeal.
Counsel, you said earlier that, you know, if the court wants to give this party a break, I don't want to speak for my colleagues. We're not looking to give anybody a break. We're looking to construe these statutes, which are obviously causing some confusion. I want to go back to what I think was my initial question to you, but I didn't get the answer to it. You didn't cite MAIC in your briefing, I believe, and I don't understand how you can square your position with that case. The Court of Appeals said the summons and complaint, to Justice Rogensack's point, can satisfy the requirement of filing a notice of appeal. So I'm not understanding how you square your argument with that case. Could you address that specifically?
Yes. Please? So first of all, MIAC was pre-amendment to the statute, so it did not address the current incarnation of the statute.
But why does that matter? Because there's no substantive change in the statute. There's wording changes. It appears to me it was all stylistic. It still references service on the clerk. I don't see what the distinction is. Are you saying we just drop MAIC because it applied to the predecessor statute that only made stylistic changes? The substance is still there.
If you look back at 66.60, it was actually one long, convoluted sentence. I haven't counted up the total words, but it went on and on and on. So those stylistic changes may not have been substantive, but they certainly drove home the point in breaking that up and creating the second sentence that says the person appealing shall serve a written notice of appeal upon the clerk. At the time of MAIC, the other reason it's distinguishable or not applicable here is because the court specifically notes that there was nothing in the statute that said what a notice of appeal had to contain. We now know from the statute, from what I pointed out earlier, 66.0703, sub 12, sub E, an appeal under this subsection is the sole remedy, one of the things pointed out in MJ. But it goes on to say that the notice of appeal must do three things. And so I do think that this case is different from MJ because of the importance under the statute or the language under the statute that you have to serve a notice of appeal. It's been undisputed in this case from day one, they have to do the second document. They have to do the notice of appeal. It's inherent in all of the briefing, all of the procedure in this case, and it's clear. Their opening brief, quote, the notice of appeal is a separate action from the initiating pleading, dashes, the summons and complaint, close quote. That's their opening brief, page 11. It's also repeated generally at pages 14. So there's no dispute it's a separate document that has to be done. What they're trying to do is get around the fact that they waited 23 days later to finally do something about it. They never filed it in court. They never served it on the clerk. They never gave it to Mark Bloom with the initial package of stuff. Hey, will you accept all this stuff? They never did any of that.
Can I just interject with a quick question? The Court of Appeals dispensed with this case in just a few paragraph opinion. And they determined that they looked at the plain text and they found that under the plain text that service was not accomplished here. But then they went on to determine, furthermore, the village clerk is not and never was a party to Greenwald's action. And the argument on the other side is, yes, the clerk was a party. The clerk works for the village and is therefore part of, I think he said it was part of a party or something like that. Do you agree with how the Court of Appeals characterized this? And if you did, what is wrong with the argument on the other side regarding whether or not the clerk was a party?
So we have to look back at how this issue evolved because it can get a little convoluted with the arguments that they had presented. The village's position was the notice of appeal was never served on the clerk. In arguing back that position in the circuit court and again at the Court of Appeals, they raised this issue that, well, technically she was a party because we gave it to Mark Bloom. That has not been the village's position, that the fact that she's not a party in this case is the reason for dismissal. But the Court of Appeals, in that context, when it made that expression, that observation that she's not a party, that is correct. She is not a party. If they had named the clerk as a party, in addition to the village board, and then went to Mark and said, here's the summons and complaint and or here's the notice of appeal, will you accept all of this stuff for the body and the clerk, maybe we'd have a different case. But she was not a named party to this action.
Why would she be, though?
Right.
Correct. She shouldn't be, because when you bring an action against challenging a special assessment, you're bringing it against the governing body, whether it's a village, a city, a town, what have you, not the clerk. I don't think there would be anything wrong if a plaintiff sued both the village board and added the clerk. We would just work on that during the civil litigation to say, well, she's not really a necessary party. You know, we accept service. You did the notice of appeal right. Let's get on with this. We can drop the clerk out. But, you know, that's an easy fix. Here, in order to acquire the competency, the jurisdiction of the court, they had to follow the dictates of the statute. And in the MJ case, this court said that 66.0703-12A is the quote-unquote exclusive procedure. It's quote-unquote the sole remedy.
So
and it must be strictly
her,
complied with. I'm sorry.
No, I thought you were done.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. I just want to, not to put too fine a point on this, I just really want to understand what both of your arguments are on this point. So what you are saying is that in order for the clerk to have been a party, they had to name her specifically.
Yes.
As the clerk. We're not talking about suing her in her individual capacity outside of her professional role as the clerk. But they needed to name her as the clerk, and that would have made her a party. But as I understand your position, just because she is an employee of the village and just because there is an attorney for the village, she does not automatically become a party.
That's correct. And the reason for that is, you know, both the entity rule, which is discussed in our brief and which the petitioner here does not respond to in their reply, and just a matter of practice. When a local attorney is retained by a local government, it's through a contract or arrangement like that, and they are retained directly by the governing body. They represent directly the governing body. And this court's case law, whether we're talking governmental entities or corporations, the attorney represents the body corporate. They do not represent any particular officer. So it's not just the fact that they are trying to create an end around here by saying, well, he also represents the clerk. Well, in the next case down the line, they could serve it on someone else. They could serve it on the finance. They could say the attorney represents the finance director. The attorney represents the plan, the commissioner who recommended the assessment or what have you. That's just not the way the entity rule works. And I'd also point out it's not the job of Attorney Bloom to teach the Greenwalds how to sue his client.
You know, there's also say that I'm not going to accept service of this action, too.
And at that time, I think what Mark was thinking was, you've given me a summons and complaint to start a court action. I will accept that on behalf of the governing body because that's who you're suing. And he was waiting around. We were all waiting around. Is there going to be a notice of appeal? They never filed the notice of appeal. And I don't think it was Mark's job to go back to an adversary and say, I don't think you're properly perfecting your lawsuit. This is what you need to do. I think that's a breach of ethics. This is how you can go about suing my client. You can't do that. There's also, throughout the briefing, there's this notion that GFLP, the Greenwalds, are some kind of hapless victim here. And I want to point out to the court that they are not a hapless
counsel,
victim.
Counsel, I think Justice Hagedorn is trying to say something. Let me just check in.
Okay. Yes. Thanks. I just want to clarify the argument that was being made earlier, because I hear three different kind of things maybe being mixed together, and I want to get them analytically separate. So in order for 801.14 to apply, you need to be dealing with, you know, a party and maybe the attorney in that case. And I heard you saying maybe three different things. I want to square them up. Early in the argument, I heard you say the village attorney is not a party because even if they accepted the summons and complaints, they didn't appear in that case. So that's one separate argument. Then I also heard you say that the village attorney does not represent the clerk and therefore couldn't have accepted service in this capacity. That seems to me to be a separate argument. And then there's a third point, which is that the village clerk is not a party. And that seems related, but in some ways unrelated analytically to the other two. And just following up on Justice Kurofsky's question, if not a party, if the village clerk is not a party, then 801.14 doesn't apply, doesn't matter the scope of the representation necessarily at that point. And that would, then 801.14 sub 1 is inapplicable, right? I mean, each of those three seem to me to be separate points potentially in your favor if we accepted any one of them. But they're all different, I think. And I wondered if you might want to expand on or clarify any of those.
Well, they are different, but it's not so much a different argument, Justice Hagedorn. We're not making three different arguments. It's three different points of fact. Number one, it's a fact that Attorney Mark Bloom, who is a general counsel for the village, did not appear in this lawsuit. The reason for that is he does not do litigation. The practical reality is when someone gets sued, including villages and towns, they tender it to their insurance carrier. The insurance carrier then assigned litigation counsel, and that's me to represent the village in this action. So Attorney Bloom did not appear. Number two, factually, he does not represent the village clerk. He is retained as a separate counsel as general counsel for the village of Maguanico. He represents several other different communities. Not every municipality in the state has a municipal attorney. Some retain them, some have them on staff, such as a large city like Milwaukee or Madison. In this case, Attorney Bloom represents two or three different communities in Waukesha County area, and here he represents the village of Board. He is not retained to represent the village clerk. And the third factual point, and it's again a fact, it's right in the complaint. The complaint is the Greenwald Family Limited Partnership and Darwin Greenwald versus the village of Maguanago. So for all three of those factual reasons, 801.14 just does not apply here. It would have applied here, I think, if Attorney Bloom accepted waiver of the admission of service of the summons and complaint and the notice of appeal, and if he had walked into court and answered the lawsuit, or if he had accepted the summons and complaint, answered the lawsuit, and then Attorney Sakata filed the notice of appeal with the clerk of court and then handed it to Mark Bloom. Maybe it would have applied, I don't know, but it's just not our case.
Can you clarify for me when the 90 days started?
Yeah, the 90 days, which, you know, isn't the issue in this case, but nonetheless, it would have been triggered by the publication or the certification of mailing from the clerk, which would have been January 16th, 2020.
So what is 90 days from that? April 16th-ish?
Correct. Yes, April 15th, correct. One of the themes that runs through the petitioner's briefing is that the Greenwalds are a hapless resident. You know, they are represented by counsel. They have a total of 37 different lawsuits in Waukesha County, including seven against the village of Maguanago currently.
That is not in the record, is it?
It's not in the record. It's in the court's.
What's not in the record?
It's in the court's docket system. And I think that this court can take judicial notice of the fact that they have repeatedly sued the village, and it would not have been Mark's job to educate an adversary how to go about perfecting the lawsuit in this case.
Okay. Let me just try to go through in my mind. So January 16 is the date that triggered the 90-day notice to appeal, right?
Correct.
And then the summons and complaint was filed March 17, right?
Correct.
And then March 18, counsel sent a letter to the village council, Attorney Bloom, to ask if he would accept service, right?
Accept service of the summons and complaint, yes.
Right. And then he said yes on March 20.
Correct.
And so that was done, right?
Yes, and they filed the admission of service of the summons and complaint on March 24th.
March 24. Then April 8, counsel executed a notice of appeal of special assessment and drafted a cover letter to the person he was communicating with, Attorney Bloom, right?
He actually sent it on the 9th, April 9th.
Okay. It's not dated April 8th. I just got that wrong.
Yeah, I think it's in the circuit court briefing and hearing transcript. Attorney Sincotta emailed Bloom on April 9th a copy of the notice of appeal and his cover letter. And I think if we look at the circuit court transcript of proceeding, it's indicated that the letter that he attached to that email was dated April 8th, but it was actually...
Okay. That's where I got the April 8th from. Fair enough. But either way, April 8 or 9 or before April 15, right?
That action would have occurred...
Well, I mean, that's not
yes,
a question.
Before
April
8 15.
And 9 are before April 15.
Correct.
So the issue here in your argument is that notice had to go to the clerk.
Correct.
Not the attorney.
Correct.
So that's really the focus of everything here.
That's correct.
Okay.
Was there something wrong with filing the summons and complaint before the document labeled notice of appeal?
I don't think so. I think it could be done one of two ways. I mean, it's not the issue in this case, but I think you could. I think if someone wants to challenge a special assessment, they could file the summons and complaint and then the next day give the notice of appeal to the clerk. They could do it simultaneously. We see that sometimes in whether it's special assessment, condemnation matters, the lawsuit's filed on the same day. The service is of the summons and complaint, including a notice of appeal, and it's just all given at the same time.
The reason I'm asking is because I'm looking at SCR 24.2, which I don't think either party cited to, but this deals with communications with constituents of organizations that are represented. And comment 7 says, in the case of a represented organization, this rule prohibits communications with a constituent of the organization who supervises, directs, or regularly consults with the organization's lawyer concerning the matter or has authority to obligate the organization with respect to the matter or whose act or omission in connection with the matter may be imputed to the organization. So it strikes me that the clerk would fall into this category of people that the attorneys representing the petitioners in this case would be prohibited from communicating with after that summons and complaint was filed.
If my time's up, if
you,
I may
you
answer.
You may answer that question.
So I think there's a couple things there. Constituents, I would think, would be the trustees of the village board, not the clerk. There's another component to this, the practical component. Every day in this state, including council, has done this repeatedly. The clerk is oftentimes the recipient, even if there's litigation, they are the recipient of public meeting or public records requests, all sorts of stuff. And here we also have a statute that says serve the notice of appeal on the clerk. So I understand that. I don't know the full scope of that ethical rule. It's not cited by either of the parties in this case. It's not really fleshed out. But I don't know whether it would necessarily override what the statute says here, which is to serve a notice of appeal on the clerk. I also don't think it's necessarily offensive if they had served the notice of appeal on the clerk, even if they had commenced an action. After all, every single day, we see lawsuits all the time against a governing body, and that plaintiff is serving open records requests. Those are not always channeled through the attorney.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebecca?
Thank you. To pick up on Justice Rebecca Bradley's discussion about communications, that issue is in this case because that's 801.14 in statutory form. Deal with the attorney, not the party. What's the party under that statute is a question here. Why the heck would we determine that the party does not include the representative of the village? Why would we put a narrow construction on a rule that's designed to prevent attorneys from contacting the other side's folks? Okay? The clerk is clearly a constituent, and actually,
Here's the one they did cite, the ethical rule they cited, 20:1.13, paragraph A. They don't cite this. A lawyer employed or retained by an organization represents the organization acting through its duly authorized constituents. The statute makes the clerk the duly authorized constituent. Again, does 801.14.2 apply? More generally, does Chapter 801 apply? You know what does? Because this special assessment challenge gets filed in circuit court. Therefore, 801 applies. This court's case, this court's ruling in CED Properties, 352.613.2014, dealt with the special assessment statute. I think it's the most recent case from the court. Since the Wisconsin rules of civil procedure apply to special proceedings, such a special assessment's appeal under 660703 sub 12, we next consider when any conflict exists between the rules of notice pleading. After careful consideration, along with our prior case law, we determined they did not. The village's position would create total confusion because it's saying they agree. Certain provisions of Chapter 801 apply here, but it's a special proceeding. So let's carve out one particular statute, one section of that statute, 801.14 sub 2. Let's say that one doesn't apply. Okay, that's wrong. Clearly applies, and the Maya case made it clear. So we go back to, is the clerk of the village part of the term party in 801.14? And the reason that's critical is because serve is not defined.
Counsel?
Yes.
So that's, as you see it, the gravamen of the issue before the court that's determined on whether or not the clerk is a party. Am I hearing your argument correctly?
The clerk is part of the party. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. You can't interpret it any other way.
And that's the essence of your argument? I don't want to overstep. I just want to make sure I get it.
Well, yes, I think it is. I think it's clear. But if that was ambiguous and that was the dispositive issue about us not getting to the merits in our day in court, then the court should rely on its previous precedent and say when it's ambiguous, particularly the statute, we should allow parties to get into court. We should interpret and construe the statute to do that.
Now, I didn't see in your briefing any citation to Supreme Court Rule 40. That's not your argument here today, is it?
40?
Yes.
I'm sorry, I don't know exactly what, 4.2?
Yes.
I did not cite it. It's in the background, though, isn't it? Because we're all attorneys and we're limited by that.
Sorry. In response, when you started the very first sentence of your oral argument, you said that that was encapsulated in 801.14. 801.14 is your argument.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. As Justice Hagerman said, what's a party under 801.14 sub 2?
Yeah.
That's the key.
And is it your argument here today, contrary to what you have in the brief, that service of a notice of appeal is accomplished by service of a summons and complaint?
Yes, I believe it can be. I actually went beyond that, and this goes to a point Attorney Bittar made.
Well, I want to, since we have such short time, excuse me.
Yes, I apologize.
So, in your brief on pages 11 and 14, you indicate that they are different vehicles. They are different requirements, and you set forth how that unfolds procedurally. Are you saying now that they are not? Help me with that, because it seems to me 11 and 14, where you say they are different, now you seem to be saying they're not different. So what are you saying?
Well, as Justice Rebecca Bradley said, they aren't different, and Justice Rogan said, in substance. But when you, and this goes to why it took me some time, you read the cases and you're not sure what to do. So I said, I better provide a second document called a notice of appeal. I didn't say we have to, but yeah, it makes some sense. And there's a footnote that says, okay, do that. I think I could have just served the summons and complaint on the clerk.
And so I read page 11 when you say, As described in the statute, the notice of appeal is a separate action from the initiating pleading, hyphen, the summons and complaint. I read that to mean that it is a separate action.
Well, it's a separate activity. I don't want to say it's an action like a court case, which I think
is what...
Well,
that's what you said on page 11.
Well, it's a separate action that maybe can or should be taken. Looking back at the Maya case, maybe it didn't have to be. But let's say it is. It's still the second document. It's the second document after the summons. All, and it does say in 801.14, so paragraph 1 of 801.14, so every order, every pleading, unless the court orders otherwise, every paper required to be served on the party, every written notice, right, shall be served on each of the parties, shall be served. The next section tells you how to do that when the party is represented by an attorney. And a key point here is, I just see no authority for this, that doesn't count, that's not triggered until he appears in the case, that attorney or she. That's not the law, and that's not cited in the briefs. He admitted service on this particular case. I should be able to rely, and I have to rely, on the fact that now I've got to serve him with those documents. It's a simple way to harmonize the statutes. So if it is a second thing, and it certainly can be, and I realized, you know, maybe it is a second thing, and so a week or so after I filed and I got admission, I said, I better serve this additional document. I did it timely. And then I looked, how do I do this? 660703 doesn't tell me that. It says serve. What do? You look to 801, which tells you how to affect service. And that says serve it on the party. If a party is represented by an attorney, you serve it on the attorney. So then the case becomes, is the clerk of the village part of the party? They are. There's no reason. It would be absurd to find the clerk in this context as something separate from the party to this case. It would be absurd. The idea that you would serve the clerk and then dismiss them, talk about confusion. The way to harmonize these things is to allow 801.14(2) and the ethical rule that stands behind it to operate the way it does every day, which is that attorneys serve the other attorney. That's how we want this to run. And by the way, I asked if he had a problem with it, and so you lay in the weeds and you don't tell me, and then you give me this motion? Mr. Batar was also copied on that, by the way. And yes, Mr. Broom is the general counsel, but he became the counsel for this case when he admitted service. Everything was friendly up to then. Then all of a sudden, now we're not going to cooperate. I don't know why. We have a duty to cooperate. He's not teaching me how to do the case. The case law on this is confusing. I think it's no question. That goes back to the primary doctrine. Allow people who are challenging these assessments to get into court in an ambiguous situation. The term serve in 660703 is not defined. It's ambiguous inherently. How do we solve that? Well, the easy way in this case, because there's an attorney representing the party, is to use 801.14(2), which is what I did. In a case of a layperson, they're going to have to figure out what serve means. Okay? And on we go. That's not this case. This case is, there's an attorney representing a party. Does the clerk fall under the definition of party under 801.14(2)? Why the heck would we construe party in that case, in that statute, narrowly? Especially when it says the clerk of the village.
What do you say in response to Mr. Batar's statement that this attorney doesn't represent the village clerk, that the attorney represents the village board?
That's irrelevant. The entity rule doesn't apply. That's about internal representation of a corporation, the officers, etc. It doesn't really apply here. What applies here is how does that party interact with the opposing party? If I go start calling village board members, they'll get all over me. All right, you can file an open records request with the clerk. I've even got scolded for that. But you don't start calling different people because he represents the governing body. He would rightly object.
But according to what you're saying, how would you serve the open records request when you're saying that 801 prevents you from serving anyone but the attorney and the attorney represents the...
What I do is I send it to the attorney. I say, it is okay, will you accept this or do I have to go directly to the clerk? That's what I always do.
Okay.
Right? That's what you do if you're an attorney.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Time is concluded. We will convene in closed conference at 1:30, but for now we are adjourned. Thank you.